All right, I want to pick up where we left off in the book of Jeremiah. We left off in chapter 16. That's where we left off. Let's just get right into it. It says here, "The word of the Lord also came to me, saying, you shall not take a wife for yourself, nor have sons or daughters in this place. For thus saith the Lord concerning the sons and the daughters born in this place, and concerning their mothers who bear them, and their fathers who beget them in this land, that they will die of deadly diseases, and they will not be lamented or buried, and they will be as dung on the surface of the ground, and come to an end by sword and famine, and their carcasses will become food for the birds of the sky and for the beasts of the earth. For thus saith the Lord, do not enter a house of mourning, or go to lament, or to console them, for I have withdrawn my peace from this people, declares the Lord, my loving kindness and my compassion. Both great men and small will die in this land, and they will not be buried, and they will not be lamented, nor will anyone gash himself or shave his head for them. Men will not break bread in mourning for them to comfort anyone for the dead, nor give them a cup of consolation to drink for anyone's father or mother. Moreover, you shall not go into a house of feasting to sit with them to eat and drink. For thus saith the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, behold, I am going to eliminate from this place before your eyes and in your time the voice of rejoicing and the voice of gladness and the voice of the groom and the voice of the bride." Verse 10, it says, "Now when you tell this people all these words, they will say to you, for what reason has the Lord declared all this great calamity against us? And what is our iniquity, or what is our sin which we have committed against the Lord our God? Then you are to say to them, it is because your fathers have forsaken me, declares the Lord, and have followed other gods and served them and bowed down to them. But me they have forsaken and have not kept my law. You too have done evil even more than your forefathers, for behold, you are each one walking according to the stubbornness of his own heart without listening to me. So I will hurl you out of this land and into the land which you have not known, neither you nor your fathers, and there you will serve other gods day and night, for I will grant you no favor." Now the reason I wanted to read those 13 verses together is because I didn't want to break up this theme. And it's a very, let's face it, a very sobering picture that Jeremiah is painting in terms of God's attitude towards these people because of their wickedness. But what just really amazes me is that, you know, God is declaring all this stuff that's going to happen against them, and yet they are so much in a stupor that they can't even understand why. Just break this down. Go back to that verse 1 of chapter 16 of Jeremiah. "The word of the Lord also came to me, saying, you shall not take a wife for yourself, nor have sons or daughters in this place. For thus saith the Lord concerning the sons and daughters born in this place, and concerning their mothers who bear them, and their fathers who beget them in this land, that they will die of deadly diseases. They will not be lamented or buried. They will be as dung on the surface of the ground, and come to an end by sword and famine, and their carcasses will become food for the birds of the sky and for the beasts of the earth." Now that's quite a solemn judgment that is coming against these people. And God just flat out tells Jeremiah, "I don't want you marrying. I don't want you finding a wife and having children and having family, because what's going to happen to this land, what's going to happen to these people and to this nation, it's going to be so devastating that you're not going to want to have kids." You know, that's pretty sobering. And Paul tells us very clearly in Corinthians chapter 7, he says that marriage is basically an institution that God, that most people will enter into with God's blessing. But Paul did say he wished that most people were like him in terms of being single, because he said that as a single person, as a celibate, his attention would not be divided in terms of trying to provide for a wife and a family and all this, that he could give his undevoted attention to the Lord. Well, in Jeremiah's situation, God's not really giving him much of a choice here. Saying, "Hey man, don't even bother getting married because things are going to be so bad." I mean, I don't know how many times I've heard people say over the years, maybe you guys have heard it too, where people say, "Well, I don't want to bring kids into this world because, man, look how bad it's getting." Have you guys ever heard people say that? Okay. Well, that's basically what God is telling him, is that things are going to be so bad. But look what he's saying is going to happen to these people. And God is making it abundantly clear to Jeremiah, it's going to happen in his time. In his day, he's going to live to see this destruction and this devastation. But when he says this, And verse 4, they will die of deadly diseases. They will not be lamented or buried. They will be as dung on the surface of the ground and come to an end by the sword and famine. And their carcasses will become food for the birds of the sky and for the beasts of the earth. Now, this is the thing that people just do not get, is that if they read the book of Jeremiah, if they read a passage like this, I think a lot of people just goes in one ear and out the other over their head thinking, well, this is all boring, bland, dry history. It has absolutely no relevance to me or to us today. And people who look at it, what's being written here with that kind of perspective, they don't know what they're talking about. Because I'm telling you right now, and I'm not a prophet, I'm not the son of a prophet, but this is what it says in Revelation. It goes right along with what has happened during Jeremiah's day. It's going to happen globally. It's going to happen all over this world, because this is what it says in Revelation when it says, and he broke the second seal, and I heard a second living creature saying, come, and another, a red horse, went out, and to him who sat on it, it was granted to take peace from the earth, and that men would slay one another, and a great sword was given to him. And when he broke the third seal, I heard the third living creature saying, come, and I looked, and behold, a black horse, and he who sat on it had a pair of scales in his hands. And I heard something like a voice in the center of the four living creatures saying, a quart of wheat for a denarius, and three quarts of barley for a denarius, and do not damage the oil and the wine. And when the Lamb broke the fourth seal, I heard a voice from the fourth living creature saying, come, and I looked, and behold, an ashen horse, and he who sat on it had the name Death, and Hades was following with him. Authority was given to him over a fourth of the earth to kill with the sword and with famine and with pestilence and by the wild beasts of the earth. And that's exactly what God is saying is going to happen to Judah here. And Jeremiah lived to see it. And now, like I said, I'm not trying to set any dates and I'm not trying to do any such thing. But I do believe in what the prophets have foretold and what Jesus has foretold, what the apostles have foretold. And I'm looking around at current events and I can see that we are on the very threshold of this happening in our day. I really believe that we are going to live to see this happening to this world, to this country. I can't believe for one split second that Israel was any worse than we are back then. And God doesn't change. And when you read what's coming upon this earth, it's going to be global. And that's exactly what happened back in Jeremiah's day. And what does it say here? Read that verse 4 again. They will die of deadly diseases. They will not be lamented or buried. I really believe that this country is going to experience a situation where they're going to have mass graves. Now, when I say this country, it's going to happen all over the world, but we don't know anything like this. This is so foreign to us. Can you imagine that? That the disasters are going to be that bad? And they said they will be as dung on the surface of the ground and come to an end by the sword. I was just reading about war, right? And I was just reading about famine. It says, and the sword and the famine and their carcasses will become food for the birds of the sky and the beasts of the earth. That's what's coming to this country. And I know that people just look at me as being the biggest pessimist on the planet. And I'm just simply saying, man, you know, I'm nobody. I'm nothing. I mean, I can imagine what Jeremiah went through. All I'm doing is reading what Jeremiah said and applying it to where we're at today. Because Paul said, hey, all this is given to us for our instruction because God does not change. All I'm saying is this, man. I can read and I can see what's happening right in front of our eyes, and it's a shame because history is just repeating itself. Now, this is what God says to him. He gives Jeremiah more instruction. It's verse 5, for thus saith the Lord, do not enter a house of mourning. Now, what's a house of mourning?
Funeral parlor.
It's a funeral parlor, man. He says, do not enter a house of mourning or go to lament or to console them, for I have withdrawn my peace from this people, declares the Lord, my loving kindness and compassion. In other words, when people start dying, God doesn't even want Jeremiah to go comfort these people in their mourning. In other words, if he was to go to their funerals, it would almost be as though he was being sympathetic with them rather than being sympathetic with God in this situation. Because you know what Solomon says in Ecclesiastes chapter 7? He says this, a good name is better than a good ointment, and a day of one's death is better than the day of one's birth. It is better to go to a house of mourning than to go to a house of feasting, because that is the end of every man, and the living, or really, literally, the spiritually quickened person takes it to heart. Sorrow is better than laughter, for when a face is sad, a heart may be happy. The mind of the wise is in the house of mourning, while our mind of fools is in the house of pleasure. And it really is better to go to a funeral parlor than it is to go to a rip-roaring party. Because a person, if you go to a funeral parlor and you just sit there and there's that corpse laying there in a casket and you just meditate, you just reflect upon the fact that, you know what, one of these days that's going to be me. And then what? it's a wise person that does that. But we're living in a society, in a day and age, where if a person would do that, they think, well, this person is morbid. This person is such a negative person. But that's the wise person. The wise person will look at life through the spectacles of death, and he will say, man, I'm going to be 6 feet under the frozen ground once someday, and what am I going to do then? Am I going to be conscious? What's going to happen after I die? Most people just go through life, and they never ask these very serious questions. Well, God is saying to Jeremiah, I don't even want you to go to the house of mourning, because if you do that, you're going to give them some kind of comfort, and I've withdrawn my comfort from these people. That's what's coming. That's how bad things are going to be. And he says here in that verse 5, for thus saith the Lord, do not enter a house of mourning, or go to lament, or to console them, for I have withdrawn my peace from this people, declares the Lord. My loving kindness, compassion, both great men and small, will die in this land. They will not be buried, they will not be lamented, nor will anyone gash himself or shave his head for them. This was a practice, especially with the heathens, you know, to show that they were in great mourning. They would gash themselves to show the, how outwardly, how much they were hurting inwardly. So it's going to be a situation where people aren't even going to be able to give a person a proper burial. It's almost like that's the highest indignity, when a person's dead body is just thrown out like dung. And that's what's going to happen. He says in that verse 7, men will not break bread in mourning for them to comfort anyone for the dead, nor give them a cup of consolation to drink for anyone's father or mother. In other words, even with this tremendous disaster that happened over there in Japan, I mean, you can see that the people are given, even though they're being buried in mass graves, they're given some kind of dignity. You just see this on the news, and they're having people praying over them, and they're showing this kind of respect. At least, you know, you can think to yourself, like, look what's happening in Japan, and you can see them burying people in mass graves. But there's some kind of consolation there, you know, both for the living, and I would think to show that kind of dignity and respect for the dead. There's something to be said about that. Well, these people here, they're not even going to be given that kind of burial, where they're just placed in a mass grave. They're just going to be left open in the open field and just be torn apart by animals. I mean, that's a judgment. And I'm telling you, that's coming. It's coming upon the face of this world. You better believe it. In verse 8, moreover, you shall not go into a house of feasting to sit with them and to eat and drink. In other words, Jeremiah, he was a lonely guy. He was all alone, man. He had no friends, basically, right? And he couldn't even go and, go to a party. It was almost as though God was trying to convey to these people, you know, this isn't the time for partying. And if you read the book of Revelation, and when you read the chapter 11 of the book of Revelation, there's coming upon this world two prophets that are going to be used by God in a very, very mighty way to rebuke this world. And I believe strongly they're going to be, these two prophets are going to be Moses and Elijah. But does anybody remember what they're wearing?
Sackcloth.
They're wearing sackcloth, all right? They're wearing sackcloth. And what does sackcloth denote?
Mourning.
It's a time of mourning. It's a time of grief. It's a time of sorrow. I mean, it's almost as though even their dress is conveying, hey, this is no time for partying. This is no time for feasting, man. People need to repent before it's too late. So that's what God is telling him. Don't even go to a party. Don't get together with any kind of fellowship. Because if you do, you're conveying the wrong message, that this is no time. This is why, I don't know if you remember, there was a situation back there in the book of Kings where there was this unknown prophet that God told to go up to the northern tribes of Israel and to rebuke the northern tribes up there because they were setting up their own altar up there in Dan and up there in Bethel. And this unknown prophet went up there to Bethel, and they were offering sacrifice to God on this altar that God forbade. He said, man, you are only to offer sacrifice down there in Jerusalem where I've chosen to put my name. But these guys wanted to worship God in their own way. And so when this prophet was that God sent up there to rebuke these people and to rebuke this king, God said, I don't want you eating anything. I don't want you drinking anything. You go up one way, you come back another way. And this prophet really blew it, because he goes up there and then he rebukes this king, all right to his face, and the king gets absolutely livid and just stretches out his hand and says, seize that man. And then immediately his arm just froze, and the king just realized, man, this guy really is a prophet of God. So he asked him to intercede on his behalf, that he could have the use of his arm back. And this prophet interceded on his behalf, and he got the use of his arm back. And then the king wanted the prophet to come home with him for lunch and for fellowship. And the prophet said, no, I can't do that. God said, I'm not to eat anything or drink anything in this place. Remember that? Well, then the prophet stood fast, because if he had done that, if he had eaten and drank with that king, it would have sent a conflicting message to just simply say, hey, you know, what you're doing really isn't that bad. Maybe we can just agree to disagree. But the fact that he would not have fellowship with this king or eat anything shows, hey, man, this is a time of mourning. This isn't supposed to be a time of feasting. And then, of course, if you remember, recall the story, that prophet on the way home was duped by an old prophet to eating and drinking something, and then the Lord just judged him by having him killed by a lion. You know, so that's what happened. Do you remember that story? Anyway, that's how serious this is. It's kind of like God just said, hey, man, get away from these people, and I don't want you eating and drinking with them. They have to realize, hey, man, this is no time for partying. And I'll tell you right now, in this country right now, there's no time for partying, but that's what we people live and breathe for. And he says in this verse 9, for thus saith the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, behold, I am going to eliminate from this place before your eyes and in your time the voice of rejoicing and the voice of gladness and the voice of the groom and the voice of the bride. You know, that's what's coming upon this planet. It's what's coming upon this country. That's what's going to happen. When we went through Isaiah, that's the last book we finished up in this class here, God said this in Isaiah chapter 24, in regards to the end of the world and what's going to happen there. He said, the earth is also polluted by its inhabitants, for they have transgressed laws, violated statutes, broke the everlasting covenant. Therefore, a curse devours the earth, and those who live in it are held guilty. Therefore, the inhabitants of the earth are burned, and few men are left. The new wine mourns, the vine decays, all merry hearted sigh. The gaiety of tambourines ceases. The noise of revelers stops. The gaiety of harps ceases. They do not drink wine with song. Strong drink is bitter to those who drink it. And then it just goes on to simply say there is an outcry in the streets concerning the wine. All joy turns to gloom. The gaiety of the earth is banished. That's what I'm saying. It happened during the days of Jeremiah. It's going to happen globally, where, you know, people live from party to party, to feasting. At the very end, there ain't nobody going to be partying. There ain't nobody going to be feasting. There ain't nobody going to be carrying on. There ain't going to be any of these, Mardi Gras and all this other stuff, man. And, Isaiah predicts that the strong drink is bitter to him who drinks it. They're not even going to be able to escape. And that's what's happening here, what it says in this Jeremiah chapter 16. And then it says here, in that verse 10, now when you tell this people all these things, they will say to you, for what reason has the Lord declared all this great calamity against us? See what I mean? People were just as dense then as they are today. Imagine somebody standing up in a pulpit today and just simply saying, hey, God is going to judge this nation. You won't believe. All right, people are going to die by the hundreds of thousands, perhaps by the millions, and it's going to be absolutely devastating because of all of our wickedness and evilness. I mean, most people would just look at this guy and say, man, this guy really needs some Xanax. This guy needs some counseling. This guy needs, you know, a vacation. Send this guy away, man. God's not that way. He's not going to do that to us. I'm sure that Jeremiah had to deal with the same kind of mentality, because they were oblivious to their wickedness. So they're asking Jeremiah, well, why would God do that to us, right? We've got to the point now in this country where we're calling good evil and evil good, where the good is being attacked and vilified, the righteous are being vilified, where the wicked are being exalted and promoted and protected, right? So when a society, a nation gets to that point, well, there's nothing left for judgment, because we're not even willing to concede that what we're doing is wrong. And that's exactly what he's dealing here with in that verse 10. For what reason has the Lord declared all this great calamity against us? They just do not believe it. And what is our iniquity? Or what is our sin, which we have committed against the Lord? All right? And if Jeremiah were to come out, if he was living in our day, and he says, because you've murdered over 52 million unborn children, and because you're promoting the entire homosexual agenda, and because you're legalizing gay marriage, and because you're putting money and material things before God, he could just go on and on. Because of all your crime, and your lying, you're cheating, you're stealing, you're conniving, you're fornicating, you're sodomizing, you're adulterizing, he could say that. And people would look at him like, well, this guy, he's just hateful. I'm sure that's what he had to go through, because anybody today who stands up and says this, that's exactly what they're going to be labeled, right? Just play the hate card, play the race card, play the intolerant card, and guess what? All reasoning, all debate, all discussion, all common sense goes right out the window. And then look at the verse 11. Then you are to say to them, it is because your forefathers have forsaken me, declares the Lord, and have followed their gods and served them and bowed down to them. But me they have forsaken and have not kept my law. You too have done evil even more than your forefathers, for behold, you are each one a walking according to the stubbornness of his own evil heart without listening to me. Now that's interesting. He's talking about their forefathers. This began a couple generations before this. In other words, what I'm saying is this. When did we kick God out of our schools? How many years has it been? It's been about 50 years, right? When did we start murdering unborn children?
4 years.
In other words, how many generations have come up since these two crimes? I mean, if you consider every 20 years, there's another generation coming up, right? So now we're two or three generations removed from what the forefathers have done in regards to the younger generation. Now, look at the younger generation in terms of their spirituality. Are they acting worse than their forefathers now? See, it started way back then. The seeds were way back then when the whole concept of traditional family values and everything started to be eroded away. So now look at us. Two, three generations down the line, this country's just at war with God. So you see exactly what happened in Jeremiah's day is happening right in front of our faces, isn't it? And it says here in verse 13, so I will hurl you out of this land into the land which you have not known, neither you nor your fathers, and there you will serve other gods day and night, for I will grant you no favor. And that was going to be their ultimate judgment, that the survivors were going to be exiled out of the country, out of the land that God had given to them. And that's, in a sense, in a broader perspective, that's going to happen here. In other words, we're no longer even going to own our own country. It's just being taken over. All right, and that's happening right in front of our eyes. And that's a judgment from God. That's all there is to it. And verse 14, therefore, behold, days are coming, declares the Lord, when it will no longer be said, as the Lord lives who brought up the sons of Israel out of the land of Egypt, but as the Lord lives who brought up the sons of Israel from the land of the north and from all the countries where he has banished them, for I will restore to them their own land, which I gave to their fathers. Behold, I am going to send for many fishermen, declares the Lord, and they will fish for them, and afterwards I will send for many hunters, and they will hunt for them from every mountain and every hill and from the clefts of the rocks. For my eyes are on all their ways, they are not hidden from my face, nor is their iniquity concealed from my eyes. I will first doubly repay their iniquity and their sin, because they have polluted my land, and they have filled my inheritance with the carcasses of their detestable idols and with their abominations. Now, what God is saying here is that, yes, he's going to bring tremendous judgment upon Judah and upon Israel because of their wickedness. But it's not like God is just going to leave it there. In essence, he's just going to take them behind the woodshed and beat them within an inch of their life. But then he's going to restore them. After he has punished them severely, then he's going to call them back to the land. And he is going to restore them. And I could say the same thing with our country. I do not believe that our country is going to be annihilated, but I do believe that we are going to be chastised like you won't believe. But God is just not going to completely destroy this country. That's my opinion. I'm not trying to be a prophet, all right? But I do believe that this country will experience such devastation, starvation. We'll experience distress like you won't believe, pestilence, disease, and famine, and war, all right? But, you know, the remnant will return back to God. And I really believe that when we went through Isaiah chapter 18, now, I know people might really disagree with me, but I really believe that chapter 18 of Isaiah was speaking of the United States. Now, I could be wrong, I'm not trying to be dogmatic, but I have read that over and over and over again. I really believe it was talking about our country. And God is going to, you know, judge this country. But in the end, during the millennial period, we will be one of the nations that goes up to worship Christ in Jerusalem, the remnant. But God is just not going to squash these people like a bug. He has a purpose for them. He, even though he's compelled by his holiness to judge them, he's not going to annihilate them. And I feel like that's the same thing with this nation here, all right? And I can't say that for all nations, because there are going to be some nations at the end of the world that are going to completely be annihilated. You know, John says that every island is going to be moved out of their place. Every mountain is going to be brought low. All nations are just going to disappear in what's coming. But I don't believe that ours will, but we will be chastised, believe me. But he's at verse 18, I will first doubly repay their iniquity and their sin, because they have polluted my land. They have filled my inheritance with the carcasses of the detestable idols, all right, and with their abominations. Just throw out the abominations that we are involved with today. That verse 19 says, O Lord, my strength and my stronghold, and my refuge in a day of distress, to you the nations will come from the ends of the earth and say, our fathers have inherited nothing but falsehood, futility, and things of no profit. And can man make gods for himself? Yet they are not gods. Therefore, behold, I'm going to make them know. This time I will make them know my power and my might, and they shall know that my name is the Lord. And see, you know, in the end, people are going to recognize that, you know, God is a God of his word. He says what he means what he says. And when God manifests himself, there's going to be no doubt in people's mind that he is the Lord, that he is the God. And it's just going to do away with all these false gods. Look at that verse 20. Can man make gods for himself? Yet they are not gods. And I would say this. Look at what we have done to deny God. I'm just a real stickler when it comes to things like evolution and Darwinism. That's just making gods for ourselves to try to do away with the God of heaven. But then in that verse 21, therefore, behold, I'm going to make them know. This time I will make them know, and my power and my might, and they shall know that my name is the Lord. See what we've done in the world and as a country? We have done everything we can to minimize God's glory and his power and his place of honor. We've really done that. But there's coming a day when he's going to stand up, and when he judges this world, people are going to know. Hey, this is the God who created this universe, and he did it in 6 days. He said he clearly did. He did it in 6 days in Exodus chapter 20. And he says, on the seventh day I rested. And they're going to see that this God is capable of doing just that, creating this entire universe out of nothing, you know, and fashioning it and forming it in 6 days. And then he's going to do away with this entire universe. We are told that this whole universe and this earth is going to flee from the face of him who sits upon the throne. And he's going to make a new heavens and a new earth. We are told that in Revelations. And he says, behold, it's done. So this new heaven and this new earth that he's going to create is going to be done in an instant, not even in 6 days. You know what I mean? This is the God we're dealing with, and people are going to know then, man, wow, this is a God who says exactly what he means exactly what he says. You can take it to the bank, and he's going to prove it to people, and people are going to see it clearly. Anybody have anything you want to add to share that? Let's just quickly go through this chapter 17. I think we've got plenty of time to do it, because if you take large portions of it at one time, it says this. In verse 1 of chapter 17, the sin of Judah is written down with an iron stylus. With a diamond point, it is engraved upon the tablet of their heart and on the horns of their altars. As they remembered their children, so they remembered their altars and their asherim. By green trees on high hills, on mountains of mine in the countryside, I will give over your wealth and all of your treasures for booty, for your high places for sin throughout your borders. And you will, even of yourself, let go of your inheritance that I gave you. And I will make you serve your enemies in the land which you do not know, for you have kindled a fire in my anger which will burn forever. Now, before we go any further, when it says in that verse 1 of chapter 17 of Jeremiah, the sin of Judah is written down with an iron stylus. Now, what's a stylus?
Writing pen.
Yeah, it's like a pen. In other words, if it's iron, it's chiseled in stone. In other words, it's obvious for everybody to see, and you can't erase this. It's written down there. Our sin is the same way in this country. There's no covering it over, regardless of how much we want to call good evil and evil good. It says here, with a diamond point, it is engraved upon the tablet of their heart. In other words, a diamond point is one of the sharpest, hardest things you can write with, right? And it's written on where? On their heart. And on the horns of their altars. Which is interesting to me, because these people are quote-unquote religious or quote-unquote spiritual. But look what it says, that verse 2, as they remembered their children, so they remembered their altars and their ashram. Now, what's an ashram?
A female deity.
It's a female deity, all right, that they would worship this Canaanite goddess, this pagan goddess, and very much involved in this the rituals of fertility, all right? This was the goddess of sex. Now you tell me, do we worship sex in this country? Nothing's changed. And by green trees on their high heels. In other words, this is where they would very often offer incense to their goddess, their asherim. And it would very often involve all kinds of sexual immorality, right? Well, you know, nothing's changed. Thousands of years come and gone, but this is where we're at. And it says in that verse 3, it says, O mountain of mine in the countryside, I will give over your wealth and all your treasures for booty, your high places for sins throughout your border. Now look at that, for sins throughout your borders. O mountain of mine. In other words, he's talking about what? His country. Mountain refers to nation or kingdom. You could just insert that, O kingdom of mine in the countryside. God's talking to his people, right? I will give over your wealth and all your treasures for booty. Is that what's happening to our country? Our treasure is just being completely drained. We got no more money. We're just making it up out of thin air. Well, this is what's happening to these people. It was a judgment from God. Your high places for sin throughout your borders. In other words, God is judging them. Why? Because of their sins from one end of their country to the other. And he says in that verse 4, and you will even of yourself let go of your inheritance that I gave you, and I will make you serve your enemies in the land which you do not know, for you have kindled a fire in my anger which will burn forever. In other words, in that verse 4, and you will even of yourself let go of your inheritance. Look what's happening to us. We're seeing our country right before our eyes fade away. Anybody who has any, I think, concept of our history as a nation can see that we're not the same nation we were 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 years ago. We're not the same, right? It's going right before our eyes. Our Constitution is just being treated as a used Kleenex. All right, this is a judgment from God. It really is a judgment from God. But who has the good grace to see it? Not too many. And that verse 5, thus saith the Lord, cursed is a man who trusts in mankind and makes flesh his strength and whose heart turns away from the Lord. He will be like a bush in the desert and will not see when prosperity comes, but will live in stony waste in the wilderness, a land of salt without inhabitant. Now look at what he's saying here. Verse 5, thus saith the Lord, cursed is a man who trusts in mankind and makes flesh his strength and whose heart turns away from the Lord. Now, just paraphrase this. Look what this country's done. You could say, cursed is the man who puts his trust in the government and makes the president or looks to any kind of leader, you know, as the one to solve his problems. It doesn't matter whether they're Democrat or whether they're Republican. If we think that they're going to be our savior, hey, man, we're putting our trust in mortal man. People think that, well, the government's going to solve all our problems, man. You're really going to be smoking dope, because what it boils down to is, go back to Chronicles where God says, if my people who are called by my name will humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, I'll heal their land. Look at all our problems. They're not only innumerable, they're unsolvable. And yet people are looking to the government thinking they're somehow, some way going to come up with a solution. I mean, it ain't going to happen. It's just not. Because it says, and makes flesh his strength and whose heart turns away from the Lord. You know, as a nation, our heart has been turned away from God. And if people deny that, then they're living on a moon. Or they're just being totally dishonest, or they're living in a fool's paradise. That's exactly what we've done. And at verse 6, for he will be like a bush in a desert and will not see when prosperity comes. In other words, right before our eyes, we cannot make an intelligent decision as far as our economy. All the things that we have done, that our politicians have done, they are primarily responsible for the economic meltdown that's happened right before our eyes. That's what he's saying here. And they will not see when prosperity comes, but will live in stony waste in the wilderness, a land of salt without inhabitant. In other words, every one of their solutions have only made things worse. And that verse 7, blessed is the man who trusts in the Lord, whose trust is the Lord. Let me read that again, because this can apply to our nation too. Blessed is the man who trusts in the Lord, and whose trust is the Lord. You know, He's not just trusting in the Lord and a bunch of other things. In other words, his whole trust is in God, not the government, not this politician or that leader. Or that, you know what I'm saying? And that's why in Proverbs 3:5 it says, trust in the Lord with all your heart. Don't rely upon your own understanding. In all your ways, acknowledge him, and he will direct your path. That scripture verse I live by. And that's what this means. Blessed is the man who trusts in the Lord and whose trust is the Lord. It's not like, well, I trust in the Lord, but I'm also trusting in this political party. Are you kidding? And verse 8, for he will be like a tree planted by the water that extends its roots by the stream and will not fear when the heat comes, but its leaves will be green and it will not be anxious in the year of drought nor cease to yield fruit. If a person really puts their trust and their hope and their confidence and everything in God, it says what? This is what they're going to be. It says, for he will be a tree planted in water that extends its roots by the stream and will not fear when the heat comes. And, you know, it says basically the same thing in Psalms 92. This is what it says. The righteous man will flourish like a palm tree. He will grow like a cedar in Lebanon, planted in the house of the Lord. They will flourish in the courts of our God. They will still yield fruit in old age, and they shall be full of sap and very green. That's what he's saying here.
He's actually, both of those things are pointing to Psalm 1.
Yeah, blessed is the man who puts his trust in, you know, in fact, I'll just, yeah, that's a good point. Let me just read it real quick. That's what he says in Psalm 1. It says, how blessed is the man who does not walk in the counsel of the wicked, nor stand in the path of the sinners, nor sit in the seat of scoffers, but his delight is in the law of the Lord, and in his law he meditates day and night. He will be like a tree firmly planted by the streams of water, which yield its fruit in its season, and its leaf does not wither, and in whatever he does, he prospers. The wicked are not so, but they are like chaff which the wind drives away. Therefore the wicked will not stand in the judgment, or sinners in the assembly of the righteous. For the Lord knows the way of the righteous, but the way of the wicked will perish. That's a good point, Tom, because that's exactly what it's saying. It says that in Psalm 92. It says it in Psalm 1, and Jeremiah is basically saying that in chapter 17, that it would be like a tree planted in the water that extends its roots by a stream and will not fear when the heat comes, but its leaves will be green and it will not be anxious in the year of drought nor cease to yield fruit. And you know what? I don't even really want to, you know, emphasize that too much, because I'm not into this health, wealth, and prosperity, but I do know this, that if we make God our trust and our confidence by obeying him, all right, and not putting our confidence in men, that even in the midst of so much devastation economically, he will still take care of his people, you know, and provide for them. And then he says this scripture is so powerful. That's verse 9 of chapter 17 of Jeremiah. It says, the heart is more deceitful than all else, and it is desperately sick. Who can understand it? Now, I repeat this so often to people, that the heart is deceitful above all things. It's desperately wicked, that only the Lord can know the heart, because it says in that verse 10, I, the Lord, search the heart, I test the mind, even to give to each man according to his ways, according to the results of his deeds. In other words, this is our biggest problem. It really is our own heart. We are our own worst enemy. If somebody were to say to you, who's your biggest spiritual enemy in this universe, I think most people will say, well, the devil, Satan. But a person who really knows himself will say, myself, because it's my own heart. You see, that's what makes it so difficult for us, all right? And it makes it so easy for Satan, is he just plays upon our own deceitful heart, where we can call good evil and evil good, black white, white black. We call bitter sweet, sweet bitter. We call truth falsehood, falsehood, truth, because our heart, if it wants something bad enough, it could just justify anything, right? Rationalize anything, twist anything. We're our own worst enemy. But I tell you what, a person who's enlightened that can see that, right? Like Paul, the Apostle Paul, he took a good, hard, cold look at himself and he says, in me dwells no good thing. Now that's a man that's truly enlightened. And then he recognized, hey man, I have no goodness apart from God. I've got to throw myself upon God's mercy and put on Christ's righteousness. Now, there's a person who's finally enlightened. These people feel like, well, I'm basically good. They only come up with that cockamamie baloney because their hearts are so deceitful. You know, if their hearts weren't so deceitful, they could look at themselves and say, man, I'm a monster of iniquity. But as long as we've got a deceitful heart, we're going to keep telling ourselves we're great. And then verse 11 says, as a partridge that hatches eggs which it has not lain, so is he who makes a fortune, but unjustly. In the midst of his days, it will forsake him, and in the end, he will be a fool. In other words, he's making this parallel between this bird, who ended up basically confiscating another bird's eggs that she'd gone through the labor to lay the eggs, and then this bird takes over the nest. All right? Well, look at all the scams. Look at all the lying, the cheating, the stealing, the conniving. Look at all the pyramid schemes. Look at how people are just ripping one another off left and right. Well, God is saying here, you know what? You're going to have a fool's end because you're not going to get away with this in the eyes of God. All right? And Paul tells us in Corinthians chapter 6 that no swindler is going to enter the kingdom of heaven. And in verse 12, it says, a glorious throne on high from the beginning is the place of our sanctuary. O Lord, the hope of Israel, all who forsake you will be put to shame. Those who turn away on earth will be written down because they have forsaken the fountain of living water, even the Lord. In other words, when it's talking about here forsaking the Lord, look at that verse 13. O Lord, the hope of Israel, all who forsake you will be put to shame. Now, if you forsake God, if we forsake God, what's the implication?
That we were once walking with.
Yes, yes. All right. As a nation, we once respected God. We once honored God. We once elevated God and His words and His commandments. But we have forsaken Him. Sure, we give Him a lot of lip service, a lot of that baloney. We like to make Him into a cuddly mascot and just simply say, "Hey, man, you just stay where you're at. Don't put any demands on us, and we'll throw you a bone once in a while." That's our whole attitude towards God as a nation. It really is. And he says, because they have forsaken the fountain of living water, even the Lord. This is what we've done. This is why we're all drying up and shriveling up like a prune, you know, because we've forsaken the living water. That's it. And in verse 14, heal me, O Lord, and I will be healed. Save me, and I will be saved, for you are my praise. In other words, this is the only thing that's going to save us, right? We got to look to God, man. And in verse 15, it says, look, they keep saying to me, where is the word of the Lord? Let it come now. Now, that says a lot, because what is that saying?
They don't believe Jeremiah's bringing it.
Well, it's saying here, look, they keep saying to me, where is the word of the Lord? Let it come now. What they're saying is Jeremiah, they're challenging him. Well, if God's going to judge us, let's see it. He ain't going to judge us. He's not going to judge us. This isn't going to happen to us. Prove it. That's what they're saying, right? Look at that verse 15. Look, they keep saying to me, where is the word of the Lord? Let it come now. But as for me, I have not hurried away from being a shepherd after you, nor have I longed for the woeful day. You yourself know that the utterance of my lips was in your presence. In other words, what he's saying here is Jeremiah saying, look, Lord, I've been faithful to your word. I've been pronouncing your word. I haven't twisted it, distorted it, perverted it, or denied it. You know, I've been telling these people the truth. And he's saying here, nor have I longed for the woeful day. What does he mean by that?
He doesn't hope for the judgment to come.
Yeah, even though he's warning them of this over and over and over again, he's being a faithful shepherd, and he's telling them the truth. He doesn't want to see it happen. He's not longing for this day. And this is why I get kind of annoyed with people. Just feel like if anybody preaches judgment, they come down on them like a ton of bricks. Like, you're just salivating over the hope that people are going to be punished, or people are going to suffer, or people are going to go to hell. That is so disingenuous to me. This is the biggest crock of baloney. People who really, you know, are concerned about the welfare of other people are going to go out there and tell them the truth, even though they get so incensed with it. And in verse 17, do not be a terror to me. You are my refuge in the day of disaster. Let those who persecute me be put to shame, but as for me, let me not be put to shame. Let them be dismayed, but let me not be dismayed. Bring on them the day of disaster and crush them with a twofold destruction. Now, here's the thing. Jeremiah just vacillates back and forth between, Lord, save these people. Be merciful to these people. He doesn't want to see this happen. But then when the people are so obstinate and they're just in his face, you know, then he just says, okay, Lord, don't let me be dismayed, but prove yourself that you have warned these people. He's going to take no pleasure in it, but these people that are destruction are coming. So you see Jeremiah, he's referred to as the weeping prophet, because this guy was really torn, trying to be faithful to God, and at the same time, not wanting his own words to be fulfilled. But then when push came to shove, it was like, okay, now he's got no choice but to say, Lord, let it happen. Just apply it to a parent that loves their kid, and they're constantly warning, and their kids are just being so defiant that you finally just say, okay, this is going to happen now, and just go after them with a belt, right? And verse 19, Thus the Lord said to me, go and stand in the public gate through which the kings of Judah come in and go out, as well as in the gates of Jerusalem, and say to them, listen to the word of the Lord, kings of Judah, and all the inhabitants of Jerusalem who come through these gates. Thus saith the Lord, take heed for yourself, and do not carry any load on the Sabbath day, or bring anything through the gates of Jerusalem. You shall not bring a load out of your houses on the Sabbath day, nor do any work, but keep the Sabbath day holy, as I commanded your forefathers. Yet they did not listen, nor incline their ears, but stiffened their necks in order not to listen to, or take correction. But it will come about, if you listen attentively to me, declares the Lord, to bring no load in through the gates of this city on the Sabbath day, but to keep the Sabbath day holy by doing no work on it, then there will come in through the gates of this city kings and princes sitting on the throne of David, riding in chariots and on horses, and they and their princes, the men of Judah and the inhabitants of Jerusalem. This city will be inhabited forever. They will come in from the cities of Judah and from the environs of Jerusalem and from the land of Benjamin and from the lowland and from the hill country and from the Negev, bringing burnt offerings, sacrifices, grain offerings, and incense, and bringing sacrifices of thanksgiving to the house of the Lord. But if you do not listen to me to keep the Sabbath day holy by not carrying a load and coming in through the gates of Jerusalem on the Sabbath day, then I will kindle a fire in this gate, and it will devour the palaces of Jerusalem and not be quenched. Now here's the thing about this. What Jeremiah was commissioned by God to do, he says, okay, go over there and start talking to the king and the princes. In other words, it's the same thing as if he had the commission today to go talk to the president, talk to everybody in the Senate, everybody in the house, all the politicians. Now, the thing that he was telling him is this: you need to obey God and not carry a load on a Sabbath and not do work on a Sabbath. Now, here's the thing that we got to understand. We are no longer bound by this ceremonial law, because what did the Sabbath really point to? Because it all had its fulfillment in Christ. So what did the Sabbath point to if we are no longer bound by it? That's what Paul says, and that's what Jesus Christ has made clear. That Jesus Christ said, I am the Lord of the Sabbath. All right.
His finished work.
Exactly. This is what the Sabbath pointed to. When Jesus Christ hung on that cross, virtually the last thing he said was, it is finished. In other words, if we're not going to try to get to heaven, quote unquote, by being good people or doing good deeds or get involved in some social gospel or any of this other nonsense, but put our faith and our trust in the finished work of Christ, that's how we're going to be saved. That's what the Sabbath pointed to, resting in what God has done on that cross. All right. But now here's the thing. It doesn't mean that Christ has done all the crying, all the dying, all the suffering, and all the work, and all the labor, and then we're just going to be carried to heaven on flowery beds of ease. You know, that's not what I'm saying at all. When we rest in the finished work of Christ, we are saved not by good works. We are saved by the finished work of Christ. But here's the thing. James says, you foolish fellow, don't you realize that faith without works is dead? It's like a body without a spirit. He's saying this. Here's the thing. We're never going to be saved by doing good works. But if we are saved, we will do good works. All right? Yeah. We've got to understand that. But here's why God told Jeremiah to confront these people about the Sabbath day, because they kept breaking the Sabbath by bringing in their loads and doing work. Now, what was their reasoning? What was their motivation for breaking the Sabbath?
Monetary.
Exactly. And what did Jesus Christ say? He said, listen, you cannot serve two masters. You're either going to love one or hate the other. You're going to cleave to one or despise the other. You cannot serve God in money. You cannot serve God in mammon. You cannot serve material things. So what Jeremiah was really doing, he was putting his finger right there at the heart of their problem, as far as their leadership was concerned, that they put money before God. That's why God said, amen, if you're going to put money before me, you're just going to bring all these judgments upon yourself. And the way that you prove that you put me before money is that you keep my Sabbath. You see what I'm saying? They were justifying breaking the Sabbath here, there, and everywhere, and every which place, right? But the real motivation was, you know what? We're not honoring the Sabbath day because money is more important to us. So that's why God said, amen, you keep the Sabbath to show that I'm more important to you than your money, than your pocketbook, right? That's what he's dealing with here. And he said, if you will put me first, then he just basically says that he would really bless them. He would bless them from head to toe, from beginning to end, from top to bottom, north to south. This is the way he would bless them. That's what he's talking about here when he says keeping the Sabbath day, right? So even though we are no longer bound by the Sabbath today, the principle is still very much in effect. And if you were to stand over there at the White House, or the over there at Congress, all of our legislators, and just simply say, "Hey, man, you got to quit putting money before God, or we're doomed." What kind of response you think you're going to get?
Secret Service come over.
Yeah, you're going to be in jail before you can say, "Happy birthday." Anyway, anybody have anyone to share?